And I'm Brian. I'm a student of Colvin's for a long time, not as long as these honorable gentlemen, but I have been involved in Zen practice since sometime in the 70s. And I've been coming to Jikoji, this place, since it was first acquired or first came into Colvin's, I would say ownership, came under his guidance. And so, for reasons that remain a mystery, I have been asked to give the talk this morning. I'm not really any kind of scholar or know that much really about Buddhism or Zen, but I've been practicing for many, many years. So I'd kind of like to talk about a subject that's I'm sure near and dear to all of you, which is enlightenment. So I'd like everyone to tell me what you think enlightenment is in your own words. But what does it mean to you? Starting with Marco.
Great.
Well, we could start over here. That would probably
no, it's fine.
You okay?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't mean to pick on you.
Well, I think first you have a kind of a daily small enlightenment, so you can really every day try to expand and grow personally and go towards this, you know, final enlightenment that you may reach, but you have continuously to grow and reach this, you know, personal enlightenment. What does it mean? You can probably really fully understand that if you become enlightened, I guess. So I don't think I can have an answer for that, but it's really based on the way I see it, in transcend yourself and the world, try to become the one, reach back to the unity. But I don't know, that's hard for you to tell, for me.
It's very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to be last.
I think some of what you said about feeling one with expansiveness, I resonated with that. Oneness, expansiveness, and just feeling right, feeling just right, but not like I'm right or wrong, like I'm saying something correct, but it's just good as it is, kind of sense. That's what I envision that to be.
I don't know. I have not a clue.
Good answer.
Similar, except for I would say words fall short. Be probably the first thing, but apparently, what people have said, it is. We've already enlightened this now. It's now.
There is a well-known Zen story, probably some of you know it. It's very short. It seems that a monk wanted to be admitted to a monastery. So he went there and applied for admission, whichever thing. And so he was taken to meet the master of the monastery after breakfast in the morning. And so he went in and sat down, and they talked a bit, I suppose, and then the master said, have you had your breakfast? And the monk said, yes, thank you. And the master then said, well, then go wash out your bowl. And the story goes, at that point, the monk was enlightened. And now I get to the embarrassing part. When I first read that story about 30 years ago, I thought, this is very embarrassing, I thought, well, I just read the story and I'm not enlightened, so, you know, what happened? In the meantime, enlightenment has in the meantime, I don't like the word very much, but it has, for me, a deep sense of maturity, spiritual maturity. However, I have found that spiritual maturity cannot just hang in space. It needs to rest on psychological maturity. So I would say the combination of these two things, psychological maturity and spiritual maturity, then would sort of add up to enlightenment, some kind of enlightenment.
Thank you. Edith?
I'm not sure I know, but my first reaction is that the word doesn't have a lot of meaning for me. Other words have more meaning, but I think of, when I hear enlightenment, I think of people trying to grasp and attach, and they're doing practice to get something. I remember Suzuki Roshi saying once, our practice or our purpose is just to do this practice forever. And sometimes people ask, well, what do you get out of practice? Why do you do this? And you know, the answer comes back to practice. So I'm sure there's a lot of meaning to the word, but I try to focus on other things.
Joe?
Thank you, Peter. I mean, it's the question.
we're just generally, what does the word enlightenment mean to you?
I'm still working on that one. I haven't seen anything that matches my idea of what enlightenment means, so I don't know whether to redefine the word or redefine the idea that we can be enlightened.
Did you want to add anything else?
No.
Lance?
I guess I'll borrow from Joshu as well. Ordinary mind, just the way. I think it's a realization that you, just your ordinary functioning, seeing, hearing, tasting, that there's a very profound experience and worth in that you're accomplishing the Dharma when you just put your wholehearted attention into what's right in front of you. That's, to me, enlightenment. And maybe some of the other things that other people say too. Cover all the bases.
John?
I have no idea.
Good. John?
I'll borrow from Bodhidharma's Dharma Pierre Hickel.
Well said.
I missed the point of that. You borrowed from Bodhidharma what?
It's done. Mike?
The tea and rice of daily living. Echo Lance, I think that I don't particularly like the word enlightenment either. perhaps best for me, at any rate, understood by way of negation as really the removal or the dissolution of the story that the mind tells about life as it actually is, so that there's clear seeing of it as it is, what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, what I'm sensing, and that's something that I think for myself is encountered in hauling wood, playing the guitar, listening to heavy metal, and writing philosophical treatises. So it's all there, but very, I think, easily concealed by the mind, by the stories that we try to tell about what's happening. So sort of getting outside of the thoughts, the feelings, and then seeing them as they are. That's an approximation. And then what everybody else said, they'll also cover bases, yes. Yeah.
I guess the first thing that came to my mind was eternal.
Well, it's difficult to say because there's a certain hypocrisy in speaking about it. Not hypocrisy, not heresy, but not being appropriate to the religion, to the thing itself. Unless you're actually doing it. So the best I can do is sit here and make an honest effort. before I say a little bit more, that is, if it's not here and not now, if one's mind doesn't open here and now, when you're doing it, it's a bit sacrilegious to try to speak about it. and a comment that I'd make about it is that one feature of it is a sense of pure function. Life is pure function. The universe is functional. That carries considerable danger. Because without compassion, it's brutal. It's the worst of the worst. So, I would say that enlightened. So now speaking about it, because beyond what I'm doing now, but I'll speak about it. People do speak about it. It's Moses at the burning bush. Who told you, who spoke to you and told you to tell Pharaoh this? When the Israelites asked you, who told you to say this? Who should you say? What is his name? He says, I am. Tell them I am. Told you this. So it's an immediate sense of existing. Finally, it's a return to the Garden of Eden in a way, because you give up pride, which is the separation between you and what, and I don't say you give it up, that's what happens. You are not a story that your mind has put together from the sensations of things. You are those things happening themselves. So it's not that the tree is out there or a sound is heard. That sound is you happening. So in the Genjo Koan it says, enlightenment, when things come forth and express themselves, that's enlightenment. From the point of view of time, the sensation is also spoken of in the Genjo Koan. Ashes are ashes. Firewood is firewood. Ashes do not become firewood. Firewood does not become ashes. Each exists in its own time without a future and a past. And a concomitant feature of this is, as was just said, a film. Suddenly a film stops in your head. A film that's been going at least since you've been very, very small, and maybe from previous generations. Some genetic film programmed into you stops. And you know the truth, and you're free. But that's, as I said, a kind of sacrilege to be speaking about it in this way. And the
concomitant danger of it is that you think you know something, and that there's something then to be gotten and to be looked for and to be compared with how you feel now, and that's hopeless. One cannot grasp it or objectify it
or speak of it.
Hard act to follow.
think what I'm up against.
You have a problem.
Please.
I don't think about it and I don't use the term in my thinking, but I do sort of go on with Edith and thinking that attachment, ego, you know, the sense of I am, I own, this is, as opposed to the sense of nothing belongs to you, nothing in my body or mind. But then there's also complete, perfect enlightenment that we just chanted. And it's your turn.
I'm touched by what everyone said. When I look at the word, there's a light in the middle. So I'm a very visual person, so I have a sense that there's light within, or one is lit from within. And in that sense, I like the sensibility of the word, and it provides some guidance for me. In terms of speaking what I know about it, it is quite dangerous, I feel, that, you know, with speaking comes with a sense of, like, I know something about this, which is actually means I'm probably further away from it. But my feeling about it is that there are a couple of stages. The first one is that a sense of connectedness, and that my existence is right. My place in life is right. That we all have a place in the world. And then the next stage is the realization that it is perfectly ordinary, that the absolute and the ordinary are not different. But that's the one that's very difficult to feel around, because we confuse it with words.
Well, I'm going to sneak out by telling you three stories, three Koban stories. Everybody's answer is really wonderful. You know, to hear all of this is very, very powerful for me. So these stories address things that have been said by those in the group. I especially like the idea, the statement, I have no idea. So the first story, I was here in a sesshin, I don't know, a long time ago, and Colvin was teaching, and there was, I don't know, he gave talk somewhat like, I hope, like what I'm giving, which is there was usually very little talking and then a lot of questions and people jumped in. And so anyway, he was doing that, and a person or a young man who was here at the sesshin said that, you know, he had just come back from, I believe, a Heiji in Japan, which is a temple that Koban trained in, and said, he said, 2 years, I've got nothing to show for it. And Koban started laughing so hard that I thought he was going to fall off his cushion. And he said, oh, you are so funny. You are such a wonderful teacher. So nothing to show for it is either, you know, the highest state of enlightenment, or the grasping is continuing. You're still trying to. So that's one story. The other story is that Koban was asked to give a talk on, I don't know exactly what the subject was, but it had something to do with Zen. Not enlightenment, because that's not a word that's really used in Zen, but something like it to Zen transmission or something of that sort. And it was a Japanese or a Buddhist society, and there were many, many people at this gathering. And And he was sitting in Zazen up in the front. And so then the time came for him to make his presentation, and he got up and he lit a stick of incense and he did three prostrations and then he walked out. So this again goes to, it's immediate. It's here and now. And it's happening for all of us all the time. You know, we are all occasionally completely here and often not. The tape that Jerry speaks of is running in our minds for much of the time. And so what Coben's gift to me and to others in his practice lineage, John, others, is the gift of Zazen. Because Zazen is one of these windows where through this practice you can get out of the mind stream. Maybe it's only for a moment, maybe it's for a little longer period. But this is an important element on the path. This is an important aspect of our practice. And we don't say our practice leads to enlightenment, because that would say there's something that you're getting to, and you're not really trying to get somewhere. You're already there. It's just that part of waking up, awakening, is realizing you're already there. It's immediate, and it's here and now. So the other story is the story of Coben's enlightenment, which I was asked him about at a sesshin. I think you were at the sesshin. And I said, so what is the big deal with Kensho? That's the formal Japanese word for enlightenment. And so why can we never talk about it? So he said, well, I will talk about it. So he says, so anyway, he tells we went through hours and hours of the dissecting the word Kensho. When you said light is in the middle, that would be, Colton would be very happy to hear you say that. So he was always looking at the word Ken and the various meanings and the show. So he said, I was at Eheji, and we had Rahatsu. And at one point, I had to go to the toilet. So we went out of the Zendo and down into this lower area where there were big windows on his way. And it was at the moment of the day when the sun had come up, and it was winter, of course, December in Japan, in that part of Japan, very, very snowy. And the ice in the trees and the sun coming, there was this incredible magical light in the room. And he said, I just fell down and sat there, and it was just... I thought, finally, I have it. So I ran up to the abbot and said to him, told him what had happened and explained it. And the abbot, like Coben in the earlier story I told you, almost fell off his cushion laughing. And then Coben said, and then he would always tell my mother about it. Then Coben said, so, that wasn't it. That was the end of the story on his enlightenment. So I think what we've talked about here as the attempt to grasp something, there's no idea. There can be no idea about it. They are all really helpful. What is most important, though, is to practice as we do. Because this is cultivating the opportunity to become aware of who we are in the moment, and that cultivation is a really essential to getting off the path of suffering, and that's the most important thing, is not enlightenment but becoming someone who embraces the Dharma, and the Dharma has a wing of compassion and a wing of wisdom. And those are the way that you move forward, with compassion and wisdom. Through this practice, you cultivate and develop this awareness which leads to both compassion and wisdom. The awareness itself is the wisdom side. Becoming aware of your suffering, the suffering of others, is the compassionate side. And in that manner, you progress in life and become someone who is of benefit to other beings. Your goal here is not to become enlightened, but to become a source of help to others who are suffering by first helping yourself. And by helping yourself and becoming aware of how you are on this wheel of suffering, you, and doing this not for yourself, but for your all, starting off with maybe your children or maybe your parents and or your spouse, and slowly moving out so that you are offering this kind of consciousness of awareness to everyone, to all beings. So it isn't as complicated as it sounds. It's actually something that is happening for us in our everyday life, that we have these moments where we are completely present, where we are not anywhere else except in the here and now, and recognizing those as such is a good thing. Not recognizing them as a state that you want to return to, or as a good job, it's not like that. It's just allowing the awareness that you were completely present to allow that to just be in yourself. And by doing that, you also become aware of when you're not present. So that's what Zazen is being aware of our both presence in the moment, sitting on the cushion, not being distracted, but not trying to be undistracted, just being. And in that manner, cultivating that sense of presence, you progress on the path. So that's some of my thoughts on it. I'd be happy to have others ask questions or offer thoughts or comments.
How does ceremony and rituals, how do they play in what you just described?
I'm not sure I have the correct answer, but I'll tell you, for me, I was raised as a Roman Catholic, and I hated the ceremonies and all that, and I never liked them in Zen practice. And then I went to Tibet, and I can't tell you how it affected me to see people doing 100-mile kora in prostration. And I realized that they're not doing something, again, it's not for themselves. They're doing this in some way to benefit all beings. Their consciousness, I believe, I felt this in seeing these deep, deep practitioners, is that ceremony done without any sense of, performance or any sense of, getting something or just being present in the moment of the ceremony, has a tremendous benefit for your practice. And when you do something without any attachment and not for yourself, and it's something that's a physical event, I think it benefits others very, very directly. I mean, those of us who had the good fortune of practicing with Koban would say that, his practice was walking. Just the way he walked, he was able to transmit a kind of, he was transmitting awareness, complete presence. And to the extent you can cultivate that in a devotional practice, it can be tremendously beneficial. Again, without any sense of gaining or perfecting, but just doing it, being completely present. John?
Thank you, Brian, for the wonderful facial. I've never heard it quite described that way before, the kind of yin-yang between compassion and wisdom. You know, it's the basis of going forward. It's very helpful. You know, speaking about enlightenment, I think there's a lot of danger there, ego hooks that we can grab onto, and it's very counterproductive. And we take it, I think we take it as something that we can grab and hold and do and experience, but the teachings are very clear that it's about dropping the body, it's not about us at all.
Yeah. The idea of the two wings, the thought is that if you have compassion without wisdom, it degenerates into pity. And if you have wisdom without compassion, it degenerates into strategic thinking and harshness. And so the you know, maintaining that balance in your practice by being aware of suffering and by cultivating this open awareness, you're cultivating both aspects, being aware of your suffering, being aware of the suffering of others. What do you mean by suffering? Well, if people are attached, they want things. This is the, you know, as much part of human nature as our need to think and talk and everything else. So that's what we're actually at the root. At the root, we're dealing with the idea that we become very attached and crave and want, and that in turn, as you get older and develop those patterns, it becomes more and more solid. And so breaking that solidity is not so easy. But the that's again, as Koban would say, Zazen is the teacher. It's ultimate. It's a kind of a fundamental teacher of how you find your way on this path. How are we doing on time, Cliff?
Is anybody at watch?
It's 32. I got 12:32.
Usually there's a bell if they really want you to come up here.
Okay.
I think you're done if you want to be.
Yeah, I have one more comment.
Yeah.
If I can.
Yeah.
So like thinking of what you said, thank you for that, and everyone else. So I think it's really true, and it's like a small enlightenment of what you said today, is like that really the Zazen is helping in understanding yourself and being in the moment, which I think is part of the whole thing of enlightenment. It's not only in the Western culture, the know yourself was based on the, you know, the Greek philosophy. It was a very starting point and the end point. So knowing yourself reminds me the fact that I partially agree in dropping the body. Because yeah, if you drop the body, but you also have to be present and act. I mean, not act for yourself. And that reminds me, you know, the discussion between what's his name? In the Arjuna and help me in that.
Arjuna
and
Krishna
on the battlefield, and Arjuna is complaining, I'm afraid, I don't know what to do. Should I fight my parents, my cousins, what should I do? And he said, well, you have to drop everything, but then you have to act. So the fact that the karmasu kausalam, so you have to become the perfect action. And in a way, it's also what Buddha did. So he didn't, after being enlightened, he didn't left the world. He decided to stay to become a source of enlightenment for other people. So probably, I don't know, but you are enlightened when you can be a source of enlightenment, and or you can make someone else enlightened. And so being an action of enlightenment, being perfectly yourself and present in the moment without dropping yourself in a way, dropping yourself to be yourself. I don't know, just a reflection about that.
Thank you. Anyone else have any thoughts you want to share? Please.
Comment and a question. So since I'm staying here and coming here, I definitely feel the presence of Koban quite a bit, you know, I was very touched by what John, you know, your nation, just his influence on your practice and what you just said now about dropping the body. So my question is about an external teacher, basically. How important is that? You know, there's Zazen. You know, he gave you guys Zazen to cultivate the internal teacher, but it feels it's very challenging to drop or to continue dropping without a form of an external teacher to devote to. That's a challenge I'm coming to by myself, and I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, this is a lineage that goes back to Buddha. It's a very important part of our practice that there is got to be a connection between Koban, between Koban's teacher, going back to the Buddha, and that it's very rare for someone to make great progress on the path, although people do it without any teacher, but that's pretty rare. That finding a teacher who you know is your teacher is a big thing. It's very, very, very challenging. You know, I can tell you, for me, I was an early practice was with another teacher, Sasaki Roshi. Greg was with Sasaki for many years. And he was wonderful in many ways, but when I met Koban, I knew I'd met my teacher. And then there came a time when I moved on. I mean, Koban didn't cease to be my teacher, but I needed to find other aspects of the Dharma that kind of revealed to me. And so I studied with other teachers, Chokin Nyima, Tibetan teachers, but Koban is my root guru, my root teacher, and having that has made a huge difference for me. I don't think I'd be alive today, much less here. But I'd like others who are involved, more senior than I, Jerry, and to speak to this.
It's in the end, as Churchill said in the eulogy for Chamberlain.
What did Churchill say?
The only guide to a man is his conscience. In the end, even if you're betrayed, you have responsibility. In finding a teacher, some people just see their teacher and know it. But generally, it'll take time before you have confidence. And particularly in the sangha or in the situation around that teacher, for you to develop real confidence that this is a trustworthy situation. Because in the end, one of the features of the practice is that even our own integrity, our sense of our own integrity, is often a difficulty. So you'll hang on to things that you know are true, and they may be true, and that you value. But in fact, they're the very things which may be twisting you. And a teacher can help you develop. in someone who has is really carrying the tradition in the way that Koban was. These traditions have come out of human experience for several thousand years. No one can recapitulate them in a lifetime by themselves. And and then
there's two. One. Those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Jerry. Well, I would say one last comment. Again, this is a story, but I'm good at stories. One day I was at the Berkeley Zen Center on a Saturday morning, and we did our practice much like we did this morning, and then there's usually a guest teacher who gives an instruction. It turns out it was the Karmapa. Karmapa. There was like 12 of us. It's like unbelievable. These Cadillacs pull up, and there were more monks in attendance than there were students. But I happened to be one of them. And at that time, it was 6 months before the Karmapa died. He had cancer that had invaded his brain. But part of his one side of his face was completely without any expression. It was, you know, as if it weren't alive, and the other, he still had vitality. And he sat across from a monk, like you and I, facing this monk, and the rest of us were sitting out there. And then gave his teisho, looking, and they just looked at each other. It was almost like this monk was, I don't know, creating some connection or vitality, I don't know. But he gave this amazing teisho, and the comment that he said that I have never forgotten is that, and I pass this on to each of you, he said that each of you have a duty, an obligation to teach the Dharma, but only to the extent of your knowledge and only to the extent of the capacity of the person you're transmitting to understand and accept. So, you know, this is something that I want to leave you with, that, well, enlightenment is the subject. Daily practice includes transmitting to others. And that's done through this open awareness more than anything else, by being present and being able to really hear people and really see people and really understand people and their struggles. You're transmitting. And then to the extent of your knowledge, you can help them, but it's again limited by their receptivity. So thank you so much for your attention and all of your comments.